The Tom Woods Show, episode 2032.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2032. I'm joined by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He is chairman of the board and chief legal counsel of Children's Health Defense, and of course, is the author of the book everybody's talking about, even though it's being blacked out by all the sources you would think would want to be investigative and all that. The Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Democracy and Public Health. Robert, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So at what point in this whole crisis, starting March 2020, did you realize, number one, you needed to write a book because something was not right, and that it had to specifically be about Dr. Fauci?
I think I figured that out very, very quickly. I think I started writing the book around April 2020 because I saw, you know, I've known Fauci, Dr. Fauci, for many, many years. My family is deeply enmeshed in the public health and just the whole area of public health. My uncle, Edward Kennedy, was the chairman of the Senate Health Committee for 50 years and basically wrote Fauci's and Francis Collins' budget, some of the public health institutions, the Kennedy Krieger Institute, the Gina Shriver Institute, are named for members of my family. And we have for generations a deep, deep connection to the public health agencies. And then I've been working on the vaccine issues since 2005, and I met with Tony Fauci about it, and I knew that he was not somebody who was number one working for public health. He has transformed that agency during the 50 years that he's been there from a public health agency into an incubator for pharmaceutical products. And all the metrics by which he judges his own success, by which people who work for them judge their success, have nothing to do with solving public health problems. They have to do with marketing and creating new pharmaceutical products. So between 2009 and 2016, FDA approved 240 new drugs that came out of Tony Fauci's shop. And with each of those drugs, many of them, he can personally keep patent rights to that. He seldom does that anymore. He can distribute those patent rights to his loyalist deputies within his agency. So the Moderna vaccine, there's four people who work for him. He has given margin rights for the patent. So they will make $150,000 a year per life or life on top of their federal salaries. He also kept half of the patent right for his agency. So his agency will make billions and billions on that vaccine. And this is true with many, many other products. And he has the power to get them approved because he controls the panel within FDA. That approved new drugs. Virtually everybody who sits on those panels or allowed to sit on those panels are people who his agency is giving grants to year by year. So he has this kind of pipeline that he has developed over years that out to the pharmaceutical companies who are all his partners. And the entire regulatory purpose of NIH has been subsumed by the mercantile and commercial interests that he has been promoting for 50 years.
Before talking to you today, I made the mistake of taking a quick glance at your Wikipedia entry. And in the description, the preview description, you are described matter-of-factly as a, quote, conspiracy theorist. This is not impartiality, it doesn't seem to me. How do you respond to a claim like that?
Well, you know, Wikipedia, I've actually looked at suing Wikipedia. It's very, very difficult because of the way it's structured as a nonprofit and as a platform that has essentially immunity from defamation lawsuits. The people who control Wikipedia are very deeply in line with the pharmaceutical industry. So they're not just attacking me. They attack anybody who sells vitamins, they attack vitamins themselves, they attack nutrients, they attack anything that competes with pharmaceutical products. And Gary Null, Dr. Gary Null, has actually, because the defamation against him is so dramatic, he is actually litigating against them. And I think he will win that litigation. You have to sue the individuals who write those descriptions. So with my description, there's an illusion in Wikipedia that you can change the description if it's inaccurate. But for people like me, that is not available. They have a ironclad control that as soon as I would change a description like a conspiracy theory or even answer it, it will trigger alarms and, you know, with this internal group who will immediately flip it back. So Wikipedia, you know, I use Wikipedia all the time because it is a very, very convenient sort of encyclopedia. But if I'm looking for something that departs from the pharmaceutical paradigm, you cannot count on it.
Yeah. I think your book has maybe one of the best summaries of the negative consequences and the collateral damage of the lockdowns that I've seen. It's just relentless, just one fact after another, over and over and over, the devastation caused by them. Now, I think a lot of people who belong to the Democratic Party have belonged to it because they think of it as the party of the little guy and the common man. And yet you've shown in the book how absolutely devastating the lockdowns were for the common man. Do you feel politically homeless right now?
I'm really alarmed by what's happening in the Democratic Party. And as you know, as you say, lockdowns were a war on the poor. And there's no good scientific evidence that the lockdowns achieved anything. In fact, the states that had the least rigorous lockdowns, say like Florida and Minnesota, had fewer death rates and fewer COVID problems than the comparable states that had much tougher lockdowns. If you compare Florida to California or to New York, Florida has a much older population, but the death rate was much, much lower. And if you compare Minnesota and Wisconsin, which are very, very similar demographically, it's the state with the least lockdown restrictions are actually doing much better. And we've seen that across the world. I mean, the African countries are, you know, they never got a pandemic. The death rate in Nigeria is 14 people per million population compared to our death rate, which is 2,200 per million population. But the lockdowns, although they were not effective at stopping COVID, they were very effective at brutalizing the poor. And the death rate in Compton was three times the death rate in Bel Air. So people who were wealthy and kind of were traditional liberals did very, very well. Their children were computer literate. They could go to school on Zoom. It was a 20-month vacation for a lot of people. But if you lived in a poor part of this country, you were in a nightmare situation. And it made no sense that we know everything we know about COVID is we know it does not spread outdoors. We know it spreads indoors. So why would you lock the entire population indoors? Literally everything they did was the inverse of what you would want to do if you actually were interested in public health. You know, you would want to get people vitamin D. You would want to get them early treatment. You would want to get them hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, steroids, monoclonal antibodies, anti-inflammatories, anticoagulants. But none of that was available to people. They were denied it either because their doctors were told there is no treatment until your lips turn blue and you go to the hospital, and then we're going to give you two things that will almost certainly kill you, remdesivir and intubation. And, you know, on the issue about how little people got hurt by this, people who are liberal, who I grew up with, are deeply concerned about the developing world, Africa and India. In the early 90s, particularly during the Clinton administration, we got those nations to make a deal, which is we said, if you sign on to globalism, we are going to lift you out of poverty. So you sign on to switch from subsistence crops to commodity agriculture to GMO corn, and we will provide corporations that will buy that to sell to first world consumers, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, et cetera, Cargill. We will make sure that you are lifted out of poverty if you sign on to it. Well, as soon as the lockdowns occurred, all those nations signed on. That corn was rotting on the docks. The tourist industries were dead. All the promises that we made across the third world, we broke. There were 100 million children who were put into food insecurity, which means chronic malnutrition or death, which will affect them, even the ones who survive it, the rest of their lives. So the number of people we starved to death, or near starved, dwarf the global impacts of coronavirus, even if you just left coronavirus untreated. And, you know, even the New York Times reported there were 10,000 African children who were dying a month. Now, people died from COVID, not children. The children who died, the Lancet recently did a study that showed there was no healthy child by Johns Hopkins. They couldn't find a single healthy child in America that died from COVID. And there were children who died. There are people with comorbidities. But meanwhile, the people who were dying were people who were older people and who were at the end of their lives. The lockdown killed children at the beginning of their lives. And nobody had any thought. Nobody in my political party was, you know, they were believing that if you stayed home and you did what you were told, that that was an emblem of rectitude. And they weren't thinking about what the impact that was going to have on the global poor and the global South. And it absolutely decimated it.
You mentioned remdesivir. When I read in your book the section on remdesivir, look, it's shocking. I think I'd like you to summarize the story, if you would, because it brings Dr. Fauci in. But I guess there was a lot of hope in remdesivir that it would limit the number of deaths. The studies weren't showing that it did. So then they changed the goalposts and said maybe it'll limit the number of time people spend hospitalized. And they got a small result on that, but nobody else could replicate that result. What's the real story?
Well, remdesivir was a drug that was actually developed by the federal government. And then they made that, you know, one of these golden handoffs to Gilead, which Bill Gates had a huge stake in Gilead. So he's one of the big promoters of remdesivir, along with his 20-year partner, Tony Fauci. So they had remdesivir in an Ebola study. It was a 4-year Ebola study over 4 African countries. And in December of 2019, just before the pandemic began, the Safety Monitoring Review Board, which is an independent board, stepped in and said, you got to take remdesivir out of the study. It's killing more people than the Ebola. So they found that remdesivir was too dangerous to give to Ebola victims. And 50% of Ebola victims die. And as soon as they did that, a month later, Tony Fauci was putting it in a trial for as the only drug that he was going to get approved to treat coronavirus. Now, why did he like remdesivir? Here's why. Because it can only be given intravenously. So you can only give it when somebody is already in the hospital, which means it would not compete with vaccines. He had to kill hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, because there's a federal law, little known federal law, that is a huge obstacle to Tony Fauci. That law says that if there is an existing drug that has been approved for any purpose, that is demonstrated to be effective against the target disease, then you cannot give emergency use authorizations to vaccines. So very early on in the pandemic, doctors, hundreds of peer-reviewed publications, hospitals, et cetera, were finding that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin completely obliterated coronavirus. And in one study, hydroxychloroquine, and Dr. Carvalho in Argentina gave it to 700 healthcare workers, frontline healthcare workers, and he gave placebo to 453. Of the 700 he gave it to, not one got coronavirus. Of the 453, 53% did, who got the placebo. So it had 100% efficacy in that study against coronavirus. These kind of studies were coming in from all over the world. Tony Fauci had to kill those drugs quickly, because if they had been recognized as effective, his whole vaccine program would have collapsed. Now, remdesivir did not compete with it, because he can only give it to hospitalized patients. So he was determined to get it approved, and he put it in this study, but he had to go back repeatedly and change the protocols for that study because it was not stopping people from dying. And as you said, they were able to kind of engineer the study through use of fraud, as it turns out, to show that it reduced hospital stays by 3 days. The WHO and the Chinese simultaneously were doing studies that said it had no impact on hospital stays and absolutely no impact on deaths. Tony Fauci, who's constantly saying we can't approve hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin because there's no placebo-controlled studies, he did not use a placebo-controlled study for remdesivir. He approved it without a placebo-controlled study. So that proviso is only holds when he's trying to kill a drug, but not when he's trying to get it approved. And he got that drug made standard of care in our country. As it turns out, it kills, in the Ebola study, it was killing, I think, 50% of the people who used it for 5 days. He prescribed a 5-day protocol of use, and it kills people in exactly the same way that COVID, the coronavirus 19 does, which is through kidney failure and pulmonary edema. We don't know whether all these people who died during the first month of the virus were people who were dying of remdesivir or were they dying of coronavirus. We don't know. We have no idea because they both kill you in the same way. But what we do know is during that first year when remdesivir was only available in the United States, we had by far the worst death rate of coronavirus in the world. Today, our death rate, we have 4.2% of the global population, and we had 20% of the COVID deaths. The death rate in our country is 2,200 people dead from COVID per million population. It's one of the worst death rates in the world. It's a mystery why Tony Fauci is still there, because he racked up a higher body count with his policies than any nation in the world. Compared to this, Nigeria had a death rate of 1/1500th of ours. So 14 people died of COVID per million population compared to ours, 2,200 per million. Why is that? Well, one of the reasons is that Nigeria has a younger population. So, you know, COVID has less impact on that. But that's not the only reason. It can't account for that huge disparity. Here's what does. Nigeria has the biggest malaria burden in the world. 27% of the global malaria cases are from Nigeria. So everybody in Nigeria is on hydroxychloroquine. They call it Sunday Sunday there because basically the entire population takes it on Sundays. And it also has one of the highest burdens for river blindness in the world, which means a large part of the population is also on ivermectin. If you look across Africa, and that's a continent where many, many people are using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, the death rate across Africa is 168 per million, so 1/20th of what we had in our country. What is the vaccination rate in Nigeria? 1.3%. Nobody is vaccinated, and yet they had 1/1500th of the death rate that we have. That's something that people should be looking at. That's something that Tony Fauci should be looking at. Is he? No way. If you look at what is the most vaccinated country in the world, Gibraltar. I think 120% vaccination because they were vaccinating tourists as well. And it has a death rate of 2,900 per million. So I think the highest death rate in the world. We need to look at this. We can learn a lot from these disparities. And yet Tony Fauci has no allergy to looking at that kind of real scientific data.
Well, I think the fact of the matter is the world does not look the way it should if the Fauci worldview were correct. It just doesn't. There are too many exceptions. There are too many countries that did the opposite of what he said that are doing just fine and vice versa. Would you describe him as a sinister person?
Well, you know, in the book, I really try to avoid labels. I try to avoid even ascribing motivation to him. I don't look inside his head and say, this is the way reason he's doing these things. I just tell the facts that we know. The book has 2,200 footnotes. And I tried to make sure that every factual assertion in that book is cited in source and just tell the story. And I think people can make up their own minds, but I don't think if you read that book and see what he's done, and particularly his experiments on children in New York, you know, which these murderous experiments that I describe in a chapter called Dr. Fauci, Mr. Hyde, where he did these illegal experiments on kids, killed at least 85 kids. You know, we found a graveyard in upstate New York, in Hawthorne, New York, called Gates Hamlin Cemetery, where all of his victims, his child victims, were being buried there, Black and Hispanic kids. And I think if you read that chapter, that it would not be a stretch to describe him as sinister.
I think I can't just move on after that chapter has been brought up without asking further. Can you summarize in what way Fauci contributed to their deaths?
What happened was, I do a bunch of chapters on AZT. So AZT was a toxic chemotherapy drug that was developed by the National Cancer Institute. And it was found to be too toxic for chemotherapy. So too toxic to give to a dying cancer patient. And they threw it on a junk heap. But it early on in the HIV crisis, it was found that, not surprisingly, it killed HIV in a lab jar. And so they said, here's an antiviral, let's see if it works on humans. And Tony Fauci, because he just had kind of stolen the HIV program from the National Cancer Institute, but his agency was a backwater agency that didn't know how to develop drugs. He had to rely completely on GlaxoSmithKline to develop the drug. And the only drug they had was AZT. So he was stuck with that drug. The only way to get it approved was to cheat on the studies and to shorten them so much, because AZT literally killed 100% of the people who got it. And the subjects of that study were all dying in a couple of weeks. And he had to give them transfusions constantly just to keep them alive, and then declare the study over after 8 weeks, and it declared a success. It was a huge fraud, and they started giving AZT not only to people who had AIDS, but people who tested positive on a PCR test for HIV, and it killed hundreds of thousands, probably 330,000 people killed during the late 80s, early 90s from that drug. And he was aware of it. It's very clear from my book that he was manipulating to hide these effects. So after he got AZT approved, he wanted to, for people who had HIV, he wanted to broaden the market by getting this and other chemotherapy drugs approved for children who had HIV. And of course, no parent would allow their child to be given these highly toxic, deadly chemotherapy drugs. So he was able to get control of foster homes in 7 states. And the one that, you know, we know the most about, it's called the Incarnation Covenant House in New York City, which was mainly Black and Hispanic children. There were no medical personnel there, which they needed, because a trained nurse or doctor would not have let these studies proceed because they were tolerance studies. What is a tolerance study? He wasn't testing efficacy. He was seeing how much of this drug you could give a kid before the kid would die. And the kids were not given guardians, which is completely illegal. So they didn't have their parents to protect them. He made sure they weren't given guardians to protect them. And then he opened these houses up, these foster homes up, to the pharmaceutical industry. And they were experimenting on kids who didn't even have HIV. So they were killing children just as guinea pigs to see how much they could give. Because you want it with an antiviral, you kind of want to give the maximum amount to kill as much virus. And so they were testing these kids, and the kids were getting so sick so quickly that they refused to take the drug. These are 8 and 12-year-old kids. They wouldn't take it. And there's a film that was done back then that almost nobody saw by the BBC called Guinea Pig Kids, about Fauci's experiments. And they interview at one point a 12-year-old, and what happened, he describes this. If you refuse the drug, they send you to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital to have a tube installed in your stomach, and they pump the drug through that tube. And he was trying to take care of some of these younger kids who were being subjected. And the younger kids were saying, I'm not going to take it. I don't want to take it. And he said to them, I had to tell them, you have to take it because you don't want to happen to you what happened to me, which is they put this feeding tube in you. And it's one of the most heartbreaking interviews I've ever seen in my life. And that, you know, that is Tony Fauci at work. It was a level of barbarism. And I also go in that chapter into his experiments on the animals, on the beagles. One experiment that he funded of taking the scalps of fully developed fetuses, human fetuses, and transplanting them onto rats in order to create a media for testing, you know, shampoos and stuff, whether they would cause injuries on your head. So they, instead of testing on children, they transplanted the scalps of human fetuses onto rats, and then they would test their drugs on those scalps. So at some point in his head, he micromanages that agency. There's no, and we have person after person employees saying there is no grant that goes through that agency of which he's unaware. He knows everything and he manages it. So at some point, he made a decision that the best use of millions of dollars in taxpayer money, the best public health use for it, was to cut the larynxes of 14 beagles that they got from a breeder, so they couldn't bark and scream, and then put a head nets on them that had flies literally biting their faces off for 96 days and then killing the beagles. And he decided that that was a good use of taxpayer money. And, you know, it's not only the barbarism of those experiments and the savagery that is telling, but, you know, also that you think about all the people, the human beings who are suffering in this country, and what $500,000 would do, or $1 million that he was doing those experiments on, what they could do to alleviate human suffering. And instead, he applied it to torturing beagles to death. It's not a good story.
The story about the children, how do you account for why he hasn't been hounded throughout his career over this? Is it really just the case that if you're the establishment's golden boy, nothing happens?
It's a mystery that I talk about, that he always had this Teflon quality. And Larry Kramer, who was, you know, a gay leader during the AIDS crisis, originally one of the biggest critics of Tony Fauci, said this about Fauci. He said he dresses really well. He has this avuncular style. And when you talk to him, he speaks with extraordinary authority, but he never says anything. If you actually listen to what he says, none of it makes any sense, but it sounds like he's saying science. You know, he also has his reputation. He's been an advisor to six presidents. He's the longest serving public health official in history. And what I show is that he controls science around the world, because he has this enormous budget and he coordinates with Gates and Wellcome Trust. And the three of those individuals, Jeremy Farrar, Bill Gates, and Tony Fauci, controls 61% of the biomedical research in the world. He's given away over $500 billion over his career, and that buys a lot of omerta. It buys, you know, everywhere. And so the whole scientific community supports him because they're all on virtually the entire profession of virology is on the take. They're all dependent on his largesse.
Alan Greenspan, when he used to be the Fed chairman, used the expression syntax destruction to describe how he would go in there and just snow everybody, just saying nonsensical things, and everybody would assume he was talking monetary policy. So it seems like a very Fauci kind of approach. Do you have, as a final word, a recommendation to the American public? Of course they should read The Real Anthony Fauci. But what would be the most important thing they can do to resist this regime we're living in?
Well, I'd say people need to resist. I mean, the things that I would tell people is we're seeing the creation of institutions and instrumentalities like vaccine passports, digital currencies, track and trace surveillance, facial surveillance, the satellite surveillance, and things that already exist, 5G and GPS, et cetera, and AI that are, when they're all put in place, are going to create a kind of turnkey totalitarianism so that the government will now have the power to do what no totalitarian regime in history has been able to do. All of them have had the ambition to control every aspect of human behavior, to eliminate dissent, and they are now going to have that power to do that. And we need to mobilize before they get that system in place. We need to mobilize the American people. We need to stop them from doing these things. And everybody needs to be exercising three civil disobediences daily. You know, go to our site, join our sticker campaign where you can put informational stickers up, put three of them up a day, read the book, and, you know, start getting active, because nobody ever complied their way out of totalitarianism. The powers the government is taking, it will never voluntarily relinquish, and every power they take will be ultimately be abused to the maximum extent possible, and you cannot comply your way out. You must resist, and this is the hill we need to die on.
Well, the book is The Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Democracy and Public Health by our guest, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The link will be right beneath this video if you're watching on video. If you're listening to the podcast, it'll be on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2032. Robert F. Kennedy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.